Rosemary Kennedy. She's probably the Kennedy that you don't know about. At 23 years old, she was just trying to live her best life, or at least live up to the impossible standard of being a Kennedy. But unlike her siblings, she struggled to keep up appearances. And in a family where image was everything, that was a problem. So her father, Joseph Kennedy Sr., made a decision, a quiet one, a secret one. He approved for an experimental procedure without telling the rest of his family, not even his wife. It was meant to calm her down and help fix her mood swings. A lobotomy. Because apparently that was considered a solution. But it went horribly wrong, and it took everything from her. It took her independence, her ability to speak, and left her with the mental capacity of a young child. And after that, it was like she just disappeared, hidden away from the public eye for decades, betrayed by her own father, erased from her own family story. She was kept a secret that her family and the world wouldn't know the truth about until decades later. Hi, I'm Nat, and this is The Midnight Files, and welcome to another WTF Wednesday, where I find something mildly concerning, and instead of moving on like a normal person, I researched it for hours, so let's unpack it together. This is part two of my series on the Kennedy curse, and honestly, I'm just so surprised on how much shady behavior is going down, so prepare to be shook, grab a coffee, because we need to sit down for this one. We're picking back up right where we left off, where Joseph Kennedy Jr. was killed during World War II, and now the expectation is on JFK. JFK was born on May 29th in 1917, and compared to his older brother, his childhood was a little bit more complicated. He was often seriously unwell, nearly dying from scarlet fever at just the age of 3, and he dealt with chronic health issues for most of his life. At school, he wasn't exactly a standout student like his brother, Joe Jr. He was a bit more of a prankster, a bit more of an underachiever, but he was known to be very charming and persuasive. He studied international affairs at Harvard, graduating just before the US entered World War II. During the war was when he became a hero, saving his crew when they became under attack from Japanese forces. That story and the attention that came with it really helped launch his political career, and he started in the House of Representatives, then became a senator before eventually becoming the president. We have an intruder. He wants to come talk about the Kennedys. Then along came Jackie. The two of them met at a dinner party in Georgetown, introduced by friends. JFK saying he was immediately taken by her and saying he'd never met anyone quite like her. And Jackie telling a friend that she felt like he would have disturbing effects on her life. Actually a very accurate thing to say. And just 13 months after meeting, they were engaged. And then in 1953, a 24-year-old Jackie married a 36-year-old JFK. From the outside looking in, everything looked perfect. JFK, a devoted husband, Jackie, the picture-perfect first lady, but it wasn't the fairy tale it appeared to be, because JFK liked his secrets, and he had a lot of them. And some of his favorite type of secrets came in the form of multiple affairs. I think he may have missed the memo that marriage usually involves monogamy, and I don't think Jackie realized that she was signing up for an open relationship. Well, on JFK's behalf, that is. Let's start with one of the earliest alleged affairs linked to JFK, because honestly, it doesn't take long for things to get complicated. The same night that JFK met Jackie in 1952 at the Georgetown dinner party, it's believed he also met her sister, Lee. Some biographers say they actually met before that night. Some say they met on that night. Either way, there are long-standing rumors that Lee, Jackie's sister, and JFK had an affair. And the dynamic between Jackie and Lee has often been described as quite competitive, almost like a constant need to one-up each other. Lee's first husband, Michael Canfield, reportedly told a writer, Gore Vidal, that Lee had slept with JFK whilst they were on holiday together in the south of France in the room next to his, allegedly. There's no concrete evidence confirming this affair. Some people have speculated it may have contributed as to why Jackie later left Lee out of her will. Around the same time, JFK was also linked to actress Audrey Hepburn. Their relationship has believed to have started in early 1953, while JFK was still a senator and Audrey was 24 years old, just beginning her rise to fame, and she was filming Roman Holiday. Often thought that their relationship overlapped with the early stages of his relationship with Jackie, also in 1953, because for JFK, one relationship, you know, just wasn't the vibe for him, clearly. The connection between JFK and Audrey is often described as short, private, and very intense. But like most affairs, it didn't last. The overlap ended by June 1953 when JFK proposed to Jackie, which was seen as him making more of a clear decision between the two. Some believe even if things had been different, the relationship with Audrey Hepburn would never have worked out because his family wouldn't have encouraged it. At the time, marrying a foreign-born actress could have been seen as risky for someone with high political ambitions. Despite all of this, it's still said that JFK and Audrey remained on good terms, and she was even reportedly at his birthday party in 1962, which is the same birthday party where Marilyn Monroe got up on stage and sang that really breathy happy birthday, Mr. President. And then in 1953, gosh, he was a busy man. Just weeks before JFK and Jackie were to be married, he met a 21-year-old on a summer day in the French Riviera, Swedish aristocrat Gunilla von Post. And it said from the start that their connection was described as very intense. That first night was said they danced all night and they shared what was described as really passionate kisses. So obviously JFK was a fan of PDA. And what might have seemed like a one-off encounter, it didn't end there. By 1954, he was still in contact with her, sending her love letters of sorts, even suggesting that they sail around the Mediterranean together for 2 weeks, which is a bold suggestion for a man that is about to be married. That trip would never happen though, because JFK actually needed major back surgery that year and he had to spend months recovering after from it, which honestly feels like a little bit of the universe stepping in and going, yeah, maybe not this one, maybe just let the affairs go. But yeah, no, that didn't deter him either. And in 1955, he spent a week together in Sweden with Gunilla, staying at a castle and then staying at her family's summer house in Båstad. She later wrote in her memoir that she described that time with JFK as like a beautiful dream.
Borrowed him for a week, beautiful week that no one can take away from that.
She also wrote in her memoir, she said that JFK told her, Gunilla, we've waited 2 years for this. It seems almost too good to be true, and I want to make you happy. She recalled them driving through the countryside, singing together, like something out of a movie. But even during that time, their reality was starting to catch up with the both of them. Because later that month, when they tried to meet up in Europe again, JFK sent a letter to Gunilla in August saying, I just got word that my wife and sister are coming here. It will all be complicated. The way I feel now, my Swedish flicker, all my love, Jack. So very quickly, things became very complicated, not to mention that Gunilla was also in a committed relationship with a man named Anders Erkman. Wasn't just JFK having an affair, it was also Gunilla, and they were both cheating on their partners. After that, JFK returned back to the US and reportedly encouraged Gunilla to move closer to him, even suggesting that he could help find her work and that he would consider even discussing a divorce from Jackie with his father, which really gives you an idea of how controlled and strategic the Kennedy family was behind the scenes. Like, JFK needed to ask permission to get a divorce from his father. It's not like his father was in his relationship with Jackie, but it just shows how controlling the family was and how important appearances were. According to Gunilla's account, Joseph Kennedy's reaction was immediate and firm, saying, like, you're out of your mind, you're going to be president someday, this would ruin everything, divorce is impossible. Then later in 1956, JFK's tone seemed a bit more conflicted about Gunilla moving on and being engaged to the man that she was dating and she was cheating on with JFK, even starkly referring to her fiancé as a farmer before wishing her happiness. JFK also wrote to her, if you don't marry, come over as I should like to see you. I had a wonderful time last summer with you. It is a bright memory of my life and you are wonderful and I miss you. It's like he just has to always keep that door open just in case he can keep continuing on the affair. Then in July in 1956, Gunilla married Anders, but the connection between JFK and Gunilla wasn't completely gone, as they had reportedly had a chance encounter at a high-level profile event known as the April in Paris Ball. At the time, she was visibly pregnant, and she sent a note to him and asked her to meet him briefly in the corridor, where she reportedly says that JFK told her, "It's wonderful to see you, I love you," which is, you know, kind of an interesting thing to say to someone who isn't your wife. And just in case that wasn't complicated enough, because around the same time, JFK was also being linked to another Hollywood rising star in the 1950s, Anita Ekberg. It's believed they actually met through the Rat Pack scene in Hollywood. JFK's brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, played a key role in introducing him and his brothers to the Hollywood elite. Through this circle, it's suspected that JFK met Anita and the two would have a short-lived affair in the late 1950s. However, again, this relationship has never been confirmed, just highly speculated. And interesting enough, Anita is one of the very few women linked to John who never went on to write a memoir or publicly confirm anything, which is rare, because if you look into this, almost every female linked to him and an affair has written a memoir. Like the next woman we're about to talk about had a lot to say. In February 1960, Frank Sinatra introduced JFK to a 36-year-old Judith Exner in Las Vegas. Frank also introduced her to Sam Giancana, a powerful Chicago mob boss. Might seem a little random, but trust me, it's relevant in a moment. JFK and Exner's first extracurricular activity to really kick off the affair is believed to have taken place a month later in March at the Plaza Hotel in New York City. Over the next 2 years, Judith and JFK would have numerous encounters together at the White House after his inauguration and in his Georgetown home. There is documented proof of the visits to the White House in the logs and phone records showing around 70 phone calls between the two of them.
Come across my name in the White House logs, telephone logs, and they also came across my name in the FBI files of the surveillance of Sam Giancana.
But this is where things start to really get messy. Exner wasn't just involved with JFK. She was also in an intimate relationship with Sam Giancana, that mob boss I mentioned earlier. And JFK himself was also indirectly tied to Sam Giancana in having some dealings with him, because JFK's father, Joseph Kennedy, had allegedly sought the mob's help to secure Illinois' votes during the presidential election, a state that apparently was critical for JFK's victory. Judith later claimed that she also secured help from Giancana to influence the election during the West Virginia primary, allegedly delivering cash to help buy votes.
Contact Mr. Giancana in behalf of the president, helping the president in the West, in the critical, pivotal West Virginia primary.
He said, "I think he can help me in the campaign, in my campaign." He said, "Do you think you could set up a meeting with Sam for me, talking about the upcoming primary or I think it was West Virginia."
In 1988, in an interview with Kitty Keller for People magazine, Judith said that she arranged a meeting between JFK and Giancana during the election. However, her story has changed in different interviews over time. She's not always really considered the best reliable source. According to Exner, she wasn't just a mistress. She was a liaison between JFK and the mob. According to her, she helped made 10 to 12 trips, acting as a courier, delivering sealed envelopes, cash, intelligence between JFK and Giancana.
They had passed information back and forth in the form of envelopes.
Envelopes for the president to Sam Giancana.
Yes.
Did you ever carry an envelope for Sam to the president?
Only returning whatever Jack requested me to pick up from Sam.
She alleged that these communications were connected to a CIA mafia plot to assassinate Fidel Castro, including Operation Mongoose, a covert mission targeting the Cuban leader during a time of intense tension between Cuba and the United States. Later, in another interview that she had in 1997 with Vanity Fair, she also expanded on the claim about organizing the meetings between Jeanne Charna and JFK, saying that she also organized meetings with the other mobster, John Roselli.
The FBI files of the surveillance of Sam Giancana. At that time, they were investigating the CIA's hiring of Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli to assassinate Fidel Castro. They wanted to find out who was the link and if Jack Kennedy knew about the assassination plots, that I had passed, that I had arranged meetings between the two of them, and also that I had passed information back and forth in the form of envelopes.
The problem is there's no solid proof that she actually acted as this go-between, and that's where things really start to feel dangerous and messy, because both JFK and Giancana are connected to the same woman, Judith Exner. JFK is allegedly relying on her to communicate with the mob, while she's also involved with the mob boss herself. But when FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover began monitoring calls between the White House and Exner and realized that she also was connected to a top mob figure, it became a major security concern.
J. Edgar Hoover sat down with the President of the United States and said, "You are seeing Judith Campbell. She is a close personal friend of Sam Giancana, who is one of the most powerful underworld figures in this country."
A president linked to a mistress with organized crime ties created a huge risk, not just a scandal, but for political blackmail, influence, and political manipulation. At the same time while this is going on, the CIA are also linked to JFK and the mob working together in the plot against Castro. But these operations were highly classified, and it's most likely the FBI didn't fully know what was going on or know that JFK and the mob were working together on this particular thing. And while all of this was going on, JFK's younger brother, Robert F. Kennedy, was now the Attorney General, and he launched a massive crackdown on organized crime, aka like the mafia. And under JFK's leadership, he started to prosecute mob figures, and they increased around 800%, which is incredibly awkward considering the Kennedy's family alleged ties to mob boss Giancana, who allegedly helped him win the election and working in the plot against Fidel Castro. So Giancana now felt completely double-crossed.
Tell us whether you have opposition from anybody, that you dispose of them by having them stuffed in a trunk. Is that what you do? Will you tell us anything about any of your operations, or just giggle every time I ask your question?
Declined to answer because I honestly believe my answer might tend to incriminate me.
I thought only little girls giggled, Mr. Giancana.
Meanwhile, the FBI Director Hoover had been quietly building leverage, and in 1962, he delivered a memorandum to Robert Kennedy detailing Exner's White House calls to JFK and her mob connections. This became known as the Hoover Memo, and the implications were serious. Exner could be used as a pawn to expose the affair, use her influence on JFK, or act as a channel for the mob to gain political advantage. Hoover now had the upper hand, and he met with JFK in March of 1962, and he warned him the affair just had to end. But that wasn't even the end of it, because Exner later claims that in 1963, she became pregnant with JFK's child, and according to her, JFK urged her to have an abortion, and that even suggested that Giancana could help her arrange it because it needed to remain completely secret.
"Unfortunately, I got pregnant."
"You got pregnant?"
"Yes. I called him and I told him, and he said, 'Oh my God,' he said, 'What are we going to do?'"
She claims the procedure took place in January 1963 in a Chicago hospital. There is no official record of this, which could be due to the fact that abortions were actually illegal in Chicago in 1963, or simply that they wanted no paper trace of it because they wanted to keep it top secret. But Exner claims that she has evidence, but it was never verified. And some historians question the timeline entirely, as many believe her relationship with JFK was already over by early 1962. Now, perhaps one of JFK's most famous alleged affairs was with actress Marilyn Monroe. Some believe that they met as early as 1954, but their most widely suspected involvement with each other started between 1961 or 1962. And one of the most iconic moments that increased speculation of their affair came on May 19th, 1962, when Marilyn sang that breathy "Happy Birthday, Mr. President" at Madison Square Garden.
"Happy birthday, Mr. President."
The dress she wore that night was famously sold at auction for around $4.8 million and was famously worn by Kim Kardashian in 2022 to the Met Gala, which sparked its own controversy. Actress Shirley MacLaine apparently also saw on JFK's birthday on May 19th, 1962, JFK leave a bedroom with Marilyn Monroe. A lot of historians still remain quite cautious about the idea of this affair, and some biographers suggest that while JFK and Marilyn may have had casual encounters, there's no strong evidence that their relationship was that serious. But in saying that, there's also claims that Marilyn called the White House telling Jackie that JFK had promised to marry her. And according to author Christopher Anderson, Jackie Kennedy's alleged response to Marilyn saying this was, "Marilyn, you'll marry Jack. That's great. You'll move into the White House and take on all the responsibilities of the First Lady, and I'll move out and you'll have all of the problems." This rumored affair with Marilyn and JFK was said to have ended when Marilyn became involved with JFK's brother Robert Kennedy instead. And then in August 1962, Marilyn Monroe died at just the age of 36 years old. Her death remains very controversial, and with reported connections of her death to both JFK and Robert Kennedy. But we'll get more into that later on. Because being tied to Marilyn Monroe's death isn't complicated enough, he goes on to have another affair with a lady called Mary Pinchot Meyer. Mary and John actually first met back in the 1930s at school dances, and years later in 1954 when the Kennedys bought a house in Virginia right next door to Mary and her husband at the time. It's even said that Mary and Jackie got along pretty well, they were friendly, and they went on walks together around the neighborhood. In 1958, Mary would end up getting divorced from her husband, and then by 1961, Mary was 41 years old and she would begin having an affair with JFK. This relationship with Mary was said to be different from other mistresses that JFK had. Their connection was more intellectual and more of a long-term feeling. White House logs also show Mary visiting the White House around 15 times and often while Jackie was out of town. It's believed that Mary even spent time in the Oval Office acting as a confidant to JFK, discussing world issues, even peace policies. A letter resurfaced in 2016, written by JFK to Mary shortly before his death in 1963, and it would read, "Why don't you leave suburbia for once? Why don't you just say yes?" JFK was urging her to come and see him. And then 1 year after JFK's assassination, Mary's story takes a disturbing turn of its own. In 1964, Mary was walking along the C&O Canal towpath in Georgetown when someone came up behind her and shot her twice at point blank range, once in the head and once in the heart. I just wonder, like, did she know this person? How were they able to get so close to her to shoot her? Or like, were they just like walking past each other and he just like pulled out the gun and shot her? But her murder remains unsolved to this day, and this is where the story takes an even darker turn. Just 2 weeks before her death, the Warren Commission report had been released, which is an 888-page document concluding that JFK was killed by one lone gunman. Some believe that Mary was planning to go public with information that contradicted that conclusion. Mary was like one of those girls who always kept a diary her entire life. And it was widely believed that those diaries contained deeply personal and potentially sensitive information about JFK, including his views on peace at the height of the Cold War. There was also claims that she was involved in circles that explored influencing global leaders towards peace, even through the use of psychedelics like LSD. After her death, a CIA chief, James Angleton, was reportedly linked to a break-in attempt to retrieve her diaries from her apartment. And some of those diaries were never recovered, and because of that, conspiracy theories begin to grow, and her death might not have been random at all. Some of the women JFK was involved with were barely out of their teens, while JFK was already in his mid-40s. Like, Fiddle and Faddle were nicknames given by the Secret Service to two young White House secretaries, Jill Cohen and Priscilla Ware. Both women were in their early 20s when they were secretaries working at the White House. Although they held secretarial positions, their roles weren't exactly clearly defined, and they reportedly lacked the typical secretarial skills that a secretary would have, and instead they became known for their close and somewhat controversial relationship with JFK. It's claimed that they would frequently go skinny dipping with the president in the White House pool in these private pool parties, and sometimes they would be joined by David Powers, one of JFK's closest aides. Priscilla Ware in particular also apparently accompanied JFK on several international trips between 1961 and 1963, including visits to Berlin, Rome, Ireland, and Costa Rica. And at this point, if you're wondering if Jackie knows what's going on, I think it's pretty apparent that she does. In an interview in the White House with Paris Match, when Jackie was apparently walking them around and showing them the White House, she allegedly pointed out Priscilla Ware and remarked in French to them, "This is the girl who's supposedly sleeping with my husband." Now, at this point, if you're really questioning JFK's choices in young women based on the age of Fiddle and Faddle, who are in their early 20s, the next one gets even worse because she's just a teenager. Mimi Alford was just 19 years old when she began her internship at the White House in 1962, and she would go on to have an 18-month-long affair with JFK, who was 45 at the time. Her story didn't become widely known until 2012, when she published her own memoir, Once Upon a Secret. And according to Mimi, on her fourth day at the White House, she was invited to one of these special pool parties that JFK and Dave Powers like to have.
"A group of us are going to have a swim at lunchtime. Would you like to join us?"
And later in the evening, the pool party turned into more of a cocktail party where Mimi was drinking and she ended up having a lot of daiquiris. JFK took her on this tour of the White House, you know, just really making it seem like she's special. And that tour ended in his bedroom that he shared with Jackie. And that's reportedly when Mimi says that he took her virginity.
"The president came over to me and asked me if I'd like to take a tour of the second floor of the White House. The room that we went into was a bedroom. I lost my virginity."
There's clearly a power imbalance here, and it really feels like Mimi was taken advantage of. She claimed that JFK at times would pressure her into uncomfortable situations, like at one of those pool parties. JFK apparently pressured her into performing sexual acts on his aide, David Powers, while he watched. She also alleged that he suggested similar situations involving one of his other brothers, Ted Kennedy, which she refused to do. Mimi also said that she never called him Jack, only ever Mr. President. She noted how their interactions were emotionally distant, which really highlights how one-sided the power dynamic is. A rare moment she recalled being a source of comfort to JFK following the death of his premature son, Patrick, in 1963. I mean, maybe he shouldn't have been seeking comfort from Mimi, and maybe he should be going to comfort his wife. Their final meeting took place on November 15th in 1963 at the Carlyle Hotel in New York, just 1 week before JFK's assassination, where he reportedly gave her $300, which is around $3,000 today, as a wedding gift. Now, if you think that JFK just has a thing for younger women, then think again, because Marlene Dietrich was 60 years old when he had a one-night stand of sorts with her when JFK was 45 at the time in 1962. She was performing in Washington, D.C. when she received an invitation to the White House. Marlene arrived at 6 to the White House, but she was like, "Sorry, I gotta be out of here by 7. And with that limited time frame, because of her next engagement, JFK apparently said, "That doesn't give us much time, does it?" And apparently he just, you know, led them both straight to the bedroom. And she later recalled how quickly the encounter unfolded, even joking that she reminded him not to ruin her hair before her next engagement. What stood out to me was an uncomfortable remark that JFK made when she was leaving. And he asked her whether or not she had ever been involved with his father, basically saying, "Have you ever slept with my father before?" And her response was, no, to which he apparently said, well, this is the only time I got there first. And I don't know, I just found that like just really gross that he'd make a comment like that. Like, who wants to even talk about their parents' sexual activities? Like, that's just a gross thought that you don't even want to think about. And he's like blatantly asking her that and saying that he has slept with people that his father has also slept with, which is just bizarre. In my opinion, it's a moment that many people look back on and also think it's just as unsettling as I find it. And if you think that's where it ends, it's not. Because in 1963, Ellen Romich, then just 27 years old, was living in Washington, D.C. with her husband, a West German Air Force sergeant. She worked as a hostess at the Quorum Club, an exclusive private club near the U.S. Capitol, which is basically a place where powerful businessmen and politicians frequented to drink, eat, and flirt with young women. JFK was introduced to Ellen by Bobby Baker, a self-proclaimed wingman of JFK's, and Bobby would say that JFK raved to him about Ellen's sexual prowess and one of the best times he ever had. Oh, and remember those pool parties that they had? Yeah, Ellen was also invited to them as well, whilst, of course, Jackie was out of town. But this situation raised far more serious concerns, as J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director that we mentioned earlier, also became aware of his connection to Ellen and was alarmed by rumors that she may have had ties to Soviet intelligence. Ellen had grown up in communist East Germany, and there were claims that she had worked for Walter Ulbricht, who was the leader of the GDR, which I think stands for the German Democratic Republic. And there were concerns because of this that they thought Ellen might have been a spy. And fearing a national security risk, JFK's brother Robert Kennedy intervened and was suddenly deporting Ellen back to West Germany. And she was just gone just like that. Allegedly, Ellen was given hundreds of thousands of dollars as hush money to keep silent by the Kennedys. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, especially back in like the 1960s, that would have been so much money. So clearly something was going on there, and clearly Ellen knew something. And instead of silencing her in the way that Marilyn Monroe was silenced or Mary Meyer, instead they silenced her with like a big lump of money. It's not believed that Ellen has ever given any interviews or anything like that. She's just lived her life privately back in Germany. Honestly, just wow. JFK was a busy man, shocking amount of affairs, and that's the only ones that we allegedly know about. So I'm sure there are plenty other affairs out there that he had. I honestly don't know how he kept track of all of these affairs and still had time to have children, be president, and run a whole country. It's honestly just giving master manipulator of all these situations, and I don't know if he was successfully juggling them, but I don't know how he managed to honestly have so many women going at the one time, or like one ends and the next one begins straight away. So while JFK's personal life was just filled with secrecies and controversy, it's not what he's most remembered for though. Because in 1963, on November 22nd, everything changed. John F. Kennedy was in Dallas, Texas, and he was riding in an open-top motorcade through Dealey Plaza. Jackie was sitting beside him while the Texas governor, John Connally, and his wife, Nellie, sat in front. As the car passed the Texas School Book Depository at 12:30 p.m., shots were fired. Kennedy was struck in the neck and in the head, and this moment was captured on film. Governor Connally was also seriously injured but survived. JFK was rushed to Parkland Memorial Hospital, where he was pronounced dead at 1 p.m. He was only 46 years old. Police quickly searched the surrounding areas, and they entered the depository building, where they encountered workers, including a man named Lee Harvey Oswald, sitting calmly in a second floor lunchroom. He wasn't detained at the time, he didn't appear suspicious, and was just identified as an employee. However, when workers were later accounted for, Oswald was nowhere to be seen. And that's when he became a suspect. He left the building, briefly returned to his boarding house to retrieve a revolver, and then about 45 minutes later, he was stopped in Dallas by a police officer, J.D. Tippit, who had been searching for a suspect matching the broadcast description of Oswald. And during this encounter, Oswald shot and killed Tippit before fleeing the scene. Multiple witnesses identified him, and he was arrested shortly after in a nearby movie theater where he was trying to hide. Oswald was just 24 years old and was a former US Marine who had previously defected to the Soviet Union before returning back to the United States. He was also known for being pro-communist and pro-Fidel Castro. He had only just recently started working at the Texas School Depository, which does sound kind of sus, but it was actually weeks before the motorcade route was ever even announced to the public. So although he only started working there weeks before, he would never have known that that was the intended route for JFK to go through in the car. A search of the depository later revealed a sniper's nest on the sixth floor made of stacked boxes along with shell casings and an Italian rifle bearing Oswald's fingerprints. And it was later discovered that Oswald had ordered the rifle earlier that year using an alias, A. Hiddell. He had an ID card with this alias name on it, along with records showing he had used both his real name and his alias name to receive mail through a Dallas PO box he had. Also, the handgun that he used to kill Officer Tippit was also purchased under the same alias, and photographs were even found of Oswald posing in his backyard with the weapons. 2 days later, while being transferred from police headquarters to the county jail, something shocking happened. Live on television, viewers watched as a man stepped forward and shot Oswald at point-blank range, and that man was Jack Ruby, a local nightclub owner with ties to organized crime. He claimed he acted out of anger and grief. Oswald died later at the same hospital as JFK. The official investigation, known as the Warren Commission report, concluded that Oswald acted alone, fired three shots from the sixth floor of the Texas School Depository, including one that passed through JFK and struck John Connolly, who was sitting in front of him, as it's believed the shots came from behind them, and a final fatal headshot. But not everyone believed this, because the conclusion had been debated due to conflicting witness accounts questioning different bullet trajectories. And in 1973, a second investigation suggested Kennedy was probably assassinated as a result of a conspiracy, partly based on acoustic audio evidence that hinted at more than three shots. However, that evidence was later discredited. Even so, witnesses reported hearing shots from the grassy knoll, a small hill in front of the presidential limousine, which has continued to fuel speculation about a second gunman. Because the assassination of JFK remains one of the most debated events in modern history, a number of theories have emerged, attempting to explain motives beyond the official conclusion, and one of the most widely discussed possible involvement of the CIA, particularly in context of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, which was a covert operation before Operation Mongoose that he was also involved in, and it was aimed at overthrowing Fidel Castro, which ended in failure and embarrassment for the US intelligence. Critics argue this may have created internal tensions between the CIA and JFK, although there's no direct evidence that has ever linked the CIA to his assassination. Another theory centers on organized crime, pointing to historical connections between the Kennedy family and mob figures, and the aggressive crackdown on the organized crime led by Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, JFK's brother, which some believe may have created a motive for retaliation. There are other theories also involving Cuban and Soviet groups, suggesting that either pro- or anti-Castro groups may have acted in response to the Cold War tensions and the US foreign policy, though again, no conclusive evidence has ever been found against this theory. Additionally, some critics highlight internal inconsistencies in the official findings, particularly surrounding the single bullet theory, which proposes that one bullet caused multiple wounds on JFK and on John Connolly. While this has been questioned as physically improbable, many modern ballistics analysis support its feasibility. Despite decades of investigations, none of these theories have been definitively proven, but combinations of conflicting accounts, complex political context, unsolved questions has allowed speculation to persist for generations about JFK's assassination. I think it's fair to say that JFK's life is pretty crazy, And there's a lot of darkness surrounding his life and his own actions towards the people closest to him. And he's had some bad things happen to him. And that's not even everything. But I think we're just going to leave it there for him, because I don't know about you, but I'm pretty good to not talk about him anymore. I think it's fair to say that Joseph Kennedy is not really off to the best start with having children. His first son is killed in war, and then his second son is assassinated. His second son has very, very questionable life decisions and choices that you can make your own decision about. I personally think, you know, he's probably not the best person, and he's done a lot of terrible things to people. But when we talk about the Kennedy family, one of the most tragic and often overlooked stories is that of Rosemary Kennedy, the third child to be born after Joe Jr. and JFK, sometimes referred to as the Forgotten Kennedy. She was born on the 13th of September, 1918. But from the very beginning, something wasn't quite right, and it was widely believed that during birth, there was a delay in the doctor arriving, and Rosemary's head remained in the birth canal for an extended period of time, around 2 hours. And this likely caused hypoxia, which is basically a lack of oxygen to the brain, leading in lifelong developmental changes. And as a result of this, as Rosemary grew up, she struggled a lot. She walked slower, talked slower, and found school particularly difficult. In a family of extremely high achievers, this made her stand out and not in a way that aligned with the Kennedy image. Despite all of this, she was still a really beautiful and pretty young girl, and she was presented as a debutante to King George VI and Queen Elizabeth at Buckingham Palace in 1938. Publicly, she appeared alongside the family at events and photo opportunities, and everything seemed fine. But privately, things were becoming more complicated. As she got older, it was said that she experienced mood swings, frustration, and unpredictable behaviors. And for her father, Joseph Kennedy, this was a serious concern. Not for her well-being, but for the family's reputation, of course. And in 1941, when Rosemary was just 23 years old, Joseph made a decision that would permanently change her life forever. Without consulting his wife Rose or the rest of the family, he approved of Rosemary to undergo a prefrontal lobotomy, an experimental and highly controversial procedure at the time. A lobotomy involves cutting connections in the brain to alter behavior. Rosemary's procedure took place at George Washington University. The procedure wasn't the ice pick depicted lobotomy. The surgeon drills 2 holes into the skull about 1 inch deep and inserted what was often described as a blunt butter knife-like instrument to sever brain tissue. She was awake during the procedure, only mildly sedated. She was asked to recite prayers, sing songs like God Bless America, or count backwards. The doctors monitored her response as they cut deeper into her brain. The operation was only stopped when she became incoherent and could no longer speak. And that's when they knew they had gone too far. The results were devastating. Rosemary lost her ability to speak, lost her coordination, and was left with the mental capacity of a young child. Her personality, everything that made her who she was effectively gone. And in many ways, her father got what he wanted. She was no longer unpredictable, but she was also no longer herself. After the surgery, Rosemary was hidden away, but not just from the public, but also from her own family. She was placed at St. Colette School for Exceptional Children in Wisconsin, which is a care facility for the mentally delayed, where she lived in a private cottage for the rest of her life. For decades, the family created alternative explanations for her absence. In the 1940s and the 1950s, they told people that she was reclusive, living privately, or even working as a teacher in the Midwest or abroad. It wasn't until the 1960s, after Joseph Kennedy Sr. suffered a stroke in 1961, that some of her siblings were finally told the truth about her and her condition and where she was. Even then, the full story wasn't shared publicly. Eunice Kennedy Shriver, Rosemary's sister, later wrote an article in the Saturday Evening Post titled Hope for Their Retarded Children, which revealed some of Rosemary's intellectual disabilities but had avoided mentioning the lobotomy. At the time of the procedure in 1941, laws protecting people with intellectual disabilities were virtually non-existent, as her father and her legal guardian, Joseph, had the authority to approve the surgery, regardless of whether or not Rosemary truly understood or could consent to it, or was properly explained what the surgery actually involved, or that she would be awake during the procedure. That's traumatizing in itself. Over the next 20 years, the public knew almost nothing about Rosemary. Rosemary had effectively disappeared, out of sight, out of the narrative, as if she had never existed. It wasn't until 1987 the truth finally emerged to the public in Doris Goodwin's book On the Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, by detailing the failure of the surgery and the decades of isolation that followed. Goodwin's book transformed Rosemary's story from a vague illness into a documented historical tragedy shaped by medical malpractice and parental control. It's especially tragic because her condition likely stemmed from birth-related hypoxia, the lack of oxygen to her brain, something that causes permanent damage to the brain that can never be reversed. This birth defect was not something she chose, and she was trying to live with it, and it wasn't something that needed to define her entire life, but her father made it that way. And one of the biggest unknowns is how her mother, Rose, truly felt about all of this. Imagine realizing your daughter had been taken for an experimental brain procedure that was really risky without your knowledge, and then being hidden away for decades. Rosemary's story is only briefly mentioned in Rose Kennedy's own memoir, where she refers to it as a simple, tragic medical decision, never fully acknowledging that it was a failed lobotomy. What's even more confronting is what followed. For the first 20 years that Rosemary was institutionalized, it's widely believed that Rose, her other family members, visited her at all. And that raises a lot of questions. If she truly didn't know what had actually happened to Rosemary, was it kept a secret from her? Was she told where her daughter was? Because it's hard to believe a mother not wanting to find her child to see and make sure she was okay. And yet reports suggest that Rose didn't visit Rosemary until after her husband, Joseph Kennedy, was no longer in control of the situation following his stroke in the early 1960s. So it makes you wonder, was this something that was deliberately hidden from her, or was it something that she felt she couldn't confront? Either way, it just adds another layer to an already deeply unsettling story. Rosemary ended up living a long life, but not the life that she was actually meant to have. She died at the age of 86 in 2005, surrounded by her siblings. And I think her story is one of the darkest chapters in the Kennedy legacy, considering everything that's happened and everything that is to happen in part three. And that's today's WTF Wednesday. Thank you so much for watching or listening, however you've stumbled across this channel. I genuinely thought I was going to wrap up the Kennedy family's dark history in this episode. This would have been way too long if I tried to fit it all in here. So in part three, we are getting into more plane crashes, car accidents, affairs, murders, and some stories that are just really bizarre, including one involving a dead bear in Central Park and another involving a raccoon that I wish I could unlearn about. So if you're enjoying this deep dive into the Kennedys' dark and chaotic family history, let me know what you think in the comments below, and I'll see you guys in the next one for part three.